Obine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. We all know so-called ordinary heroes. Firefighters, teachers, law enforcement, community volunteers, whose careers or lifestyle choices improve or save lives. Surgeon Dr. Ernie Badai may not wear a cape, but in the world of healthcare, he is truly a superhero. The doctor had treated thousands of breast cancer patients. His tolerance of dwindling breast cancer research funding dropped to zero. Some creativity was needed. He came up with this unique fundraising idea of a global postage stamp, which would cost a few cents over the actual cost of the stamp, the excess of which would go directly to research. This brilliant idea would not only provide visual awareness, but also provide people the opportunity to financially help research without deeply impacting their personal budgets. Like a great Frank Capra movie, this everyman pushed and pushed and pushed the post office, who continually rejected his idea. So he then pushed and pushed and pushed Congress, including personally appearing before Congress, until they finally acquiesced, passing legislation to provide the post office authority to issue the stamp. So far, nearly $92 million has been raised for crucial research, and that's just in the United States. It's been issued in over 70 countries, including Croatia and El Salvador. As you can imagine, it's easy to get pulled into his passion, which affects all of us. And now, a conversation with Dr. Badai, his old friend Joe Whalen, and Breck Phillip of the Blue Gaucho Project.
Thank you for being here, Doctor. Appreciate your set aside a little bit of time from your busy schedule.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tragically, the number of cases of breast cancer diagnoses are rising, not just in the United States, but around the world. So let's just cannonball into the deep end here.
Sure.
What's the current status of research?
Well, in the last 15, 20 years, there's been tremendous advances in not only in diagnosis, but also the treatment of breast cancer. So I think that where we're going in the very near future, which is the next year or two, is we're developing what are called targeted therapies. And by that, I mean that we're going to be treating individual patients and individual cancers as opposed to treating the mass population. So if a lady is diagnosed with cancer, we're doing genetic analyses on their particular malignancies, and we'll target just their cancer. We're making drugs that will be effective only in that one patient. They won't be effective in anybody else. So it's a targeted therapy. And the beauty of this is that the way this works is that the antibodies that are made for the specific patient attack only the cancer cells. They don't attack the entire body. So in today's world, unfortunately, we're dealing with chemotherapy, which is extremely toxic and affects all the organs of the body. So that's why the ladies lose their hair, they get infections, they get nausea, they get vomiting, abdominal issues, etc. So these new targeted therapies will attack only the malignant cells, and they won't attack the whole body. So all these horrible side effects that the ladies are being put through and subjected to now are going to be a thing of the past.
Now, genetic testing can also be helpful insofar as not necessarily preventing, but being aware of, and hopefully maybe staving off some aspects of it?
Well, the genetic testing, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, as they're called, are really only done in a small set of the population. And the reason for that is that only about 5% of women who get breast cancer are gene positive. So it's not really used as a screening tool. We have certain criteria where we would suggest that a woman get breast cancer testing, and these include if you have a family history of breast cancer, which includes two premenopausal first-degree relatives who've had breast cancer, if you had ovarian cancer in your family history, or what is little known is that if there's a male in the family lineage that's had breast cancer, then we test all those women for the breast cancer gene. But it really only applies to about 5% of women, and typically the ladies that get the breast cancer gene testing are of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, Eastern European descent. That's where this gene seems to have arisen and propagated to the United States.
It's not like they haven't had a happy past.
Yeah, exactly. Fuel to the fire, so to speak.
What many people may not be aware of is that men are diagnosed with breast cancer as well.
That's correct. In the United States, there are about 1,900 men per year who are diagnosed with breast cancer. And it's a very interesting issue because most males who are diagnosed with breast cancer are diagnosed at a much later stage than the females because we don't get mammograms on males. Males don't do breast self-exams like females do. So by the time it's detected in a male, it's usually at a much more advanced stage, and their prognosis is much worse because the disease is usually at least stage 2 or 3 at the time of diagnosis because there's no screening for men.
What tests have you noticed that women have not pursued in addition to mammograms that should be part of their yearly exam, and maybe that insurance coverage may not have it under their policies?
Well, that's a very complex topic. First of all, I would say that one thing that is not insurance related is breast self-exam. So women should, starting at the age of 20, do at least monthly or bi-monthly breast self-examinations. That's free. You have access to yourself. It's not an insurance issue. They should get a clinical exam annually starting at about age 20 as well. And that's really not an insurance issue either. That's part of healthcare maintenance. Mammography remains the most effective tool that we have, and none of the insurance carriers balk at doing that. What has come up recently is the issue of breast density. And there's some recent studies within the last 5 or 6 years that have shown fairly definitively that women who have dense breasts have a higher incidence of breast cancer. Now, here's the problem. About half the women who go in for mammography have dense breasts. So it's really hard to differentiate who needs further testing, say with ultrasound, because you can't ultrasound the whole breast on every female who's got, doing millions of mammograms per year. You cannot do ultrasounds on all those patients. So you have to really be selective. And by that, I mean, again, based on the family history, how high the risk is for the patient harboring a cancer. The problem is that the cancers are basically white. And when you do a mammogram, the mammographic tissues in dense breasts is also white. So the cancers hide in there and you can't see them. And the ultrasound maybe is going to help improve on that earlier detection in the dense breast.
And of course, each patient has their own personal history outside of medical. So let's talk a little bit about yours. You were born in Hungary?
Yes, I was born in Budapest, Hungary. And I was very fortunate in 1956 during the Hungarian Revolution. My father had the courage to escape from Hungary because I have an older brother and a younger brother as well who was born here, but my older brother and I would have basically, under the communist regime, would have never had an opportunity to go to medical school and get educated because we were Catholic, and if you were Catholic and living in a communist country, you weren't going anywhere. So my father, who had a PhD in physics and in math, he's brilliant, actually gave up his entire career and left his family, his parents, and siblings to get my brother and myself out into the United States. And he had a very tragic life because, you know, he was brilliant. He was very smart. But he couldn't get a job here in the United States because he couldn't get a secret clearance because he had relatives behind the Iron Curtain. And so he had a very tragic life. And he basically gave up his diplomas so that my brother and I could get educated. My older brother's a dentist, and I'm a physician. But he really sacrificed a lot. He gave up everything for the good of his kids.
And how did he spend his life after arriving here?
Well, he had basically labor-type jobs. My mom was cleaning homes. My dad was a bricklayer. Eventually, he worked up his way up into some of the university systems and became a professor and was able to teach. Then when he tried to get into the aerospace industry is when everything kind of collapsed.
Hit the fan, huh?
Yeah, it was really tragic watching him. You know, I'm the first one in my family that was ever able to buy a house. He was never able to buy a home. You know, when we first came to the United States, we literally didn't have a penny to our names. I didn't speak a word of English. My dad didn't speak a word of English, nor my mom. So it was a struggle. And to be honest with you, I took that experience as motivation for my own life. And I said, you know what? I'm going to really work hard and be as successful as I can because I don't want my kids to go through what I went through because of what my dad gave up for us. So that whole experience really was the motivation for me to become an achiever and to take advantage of the United States and the opportunity that it provided for us at that time.
Your dad set a high bar.
He did. He did set a high bar, and then I ingrained that in myself. And, you know, many of the things that I've done in my life are really dedicated to my dad. I have several speeches that I give that where I dedicated to my father, because without him, I wouldn't be giving that speech.
What was his name?
Conrad Bodai.
Cheers. Toast to Conrad.
Cheers to Conrad.
Now, how old were you when you came to this country?
I was 7 years old when we emigrated into the United States.
So when you entered the school system, which is where?
I was in Ithaca, New York, and I was 7 years old, and I had a... That was an interesting issue because I was didn't speak a word of English. So I got put in the second grade, and my real first name is Balazs. It's not Ernie. And if you're in second grade with a name like Balazs and you don't speak English, kids can be a little bit cruel. You know, bullying is not a current issue. It's been around forever. And what the hell, it was rough. That's why I changed my middle name, which is Imre. I changed it to Ernie, so I could get away from that thing. And then, you know, kids at that age learn the language fairly quickly. So within a couple of years, I was fairly fluent in English.
So you earned which degree? What was your first?
I got a bachelor's degree from UCLA in 1972, and a master's degree from UCLA in 1973, and a medical degree from UC Davis in 1977. And then I went on to do my surgical residency, which was a six-year program, after medical school, which I also did at UC Davis.
And was it during your internship, the program, that you came across a certain amount of cases of breast cancer? That was that just kind of over a period of time?
Well, what happened was when I left surgical training out and got my board certification in surgery, I went to work at Kaiser here in Sacramento. And within a year, I got appointed to be chief of surgery. And that wasn't really an accomplishment on my own. Nobody else wanted the job, just to be clear about that. Back in those days, the biggest job that a chief of any department had was to provide second opinions. And the biggest second opinion generator was always breast issues, whether it be benign or malignancies, malignant conditions of the breast. And so I found myself doing all these second opinions on breast cancer patients. And then the patients just always wound up staying with me, and I wound up taking care of them. So the bulk of my practice after the mid-80s really became breast-oriented.
Now, you've written 4 books, is that correct, on cancer?
I've written 4 books on breast, or 3 on breast cancer and 1 on prostate cancer, and then actually another book on general surgical procedures. That's a teaching manual for residents and training.
Now, on the 3 books that focus on breast cancer, what were your specific topics for each book?
Well, the purpose of the book was actually to educate women about their diagnosis, because you know, as you know, there's so much information out there, you know, and if women get on the internet and go out and buy, you know, a 1,000-page book and try and read through it, so little of that applies to the patient themselves. So the purpose of the book was, it was written at the 8th grade level, so it was easy to understand, and it was a very quick read. It was only about 170 pages long, and, you know, to wade through the multitude of books that are out there, 500-600 pages, you know, maybe 20 pages apply to you as an individual patient. So this is a sort of a primer on breast cancer for the newly diagnosed patient, so they can get right to the chase in terms of what it is that is applicable to them, and they don't have to read about certain things that don't apply to them to get the information that they need. So I've found it over the years to be a very effective tool, and the ladies that have read it, who've commented to me about it, have said that it was a real wonderful lifesaver for them, because it gave them an education as breast cancer 101. Literally, it's a 2-day read at the most.
And you've also invented medical devices which are patented.
Yes, I've had a number. My dad was an inventor, and I think I
of course
that.
He was. Was there something he didn't do? Did he mow the lawn?
He was an inventor. He had a bunch of brilliant inventions, and he and I actually co-invented some things together too. And then the invention I'm most proud of is the what's called a Bodai Neo 2 Safe. And it's a valve that goes in between a ventilator and an endotracheal tube. So if someone's on ventilator support because they can't breathe on their own, you have to be suctioned every hour because you don't have the cough reflex. It's eliminated. So you got to basically put a tube down the tube that's in the patient's mouth and suck out all their secretions because they're not able to clear them themselves. And the problem was back when I came up with that idea back in the mid-80s was that every time you disconnected the patient from the ventilator, their heart rate would slow down and someone would have a cardiac arrest. So this little gadget that I made up literally in my garage was composed of a bicycle inner tube tire. They don't make inner tubes anymore. With a slit on it and a little Y-shaped thing. So you could actually leave the ventilator connected to the patient while you suctioned them through this little slit in a bicycle inner tube. And then we made it into a real product. It saved literally thousands of lives. In fact, then we came out with a neonatal version of it for premature babies who have hyaline membrane disease, and they're on ventilators, and the same thing happens to them. It was one of the most humbling experiences of my life. Was I was back in Budapest, Hungary, on a lecturing tour related to breast cancer, and I was invited to go into a neonatal unit in one of the Hungarian hospitals, and my son was with me. We walked over to one of the incubators that the premature babies are in, and lo and behold, there was the valve sitting on this little baby. It was the Bodai valve in Budapest, you know, which was...
Full circle.
It went full circle. I mean, it literally sent shivers up my spine to see that.
Sending up mine, just listening to it. All the way back to my head, actually. It's covered a lot of territory. Now, of course, as a surgeon, you have to get frustrated when you see cancer still affecting women and men and research not being funded. So that was the catalyst for the stamp as we know today. So how did that all even begin? I mean, I know the post office, you have a protocol you have to follow for your basic stamp, but yours, of course, went above and beyond that.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. Unfortunately, if you go back into the 70s, almost 70% of all studies that asked for funding from the NIH and the National Cancer Institute got funded, and then the budgets kept getting cut back year after year after year. So in today's world, instead of 70% of all projects being funded, less than 16% of projects receive funding. So 80% or more don't get any money. So maybe there was an idea out there that would have been a major breakthrough that isn't going to get any funding. So basically, I was looking for a mechanism to raise additional funds for research, particularly in cancer and particularly breast cancer. And so I came up with this idea of having a stamp that would cost a little bit more than a normal stamp, and the extra money would then go into a fund that would raise money for research dollars. And I approached the post office with that idea, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it, based on the fact that they said they're not a fundraising organization. If they do it for breast cancer, they have to do it for colon cancer and kidney disease and heart disease, et cetera, et cetera. And those are legitimate arguments. But I said to them, well, so what? Why can't you do that? You know, never get hit by whatever cause they were interested in. So actually, I got fairly acute rejection from there, and they decided I was going to take an act to Congress to get a postage stamp passed that would be a fundraising stamp. So I wrote to the 50 female representatives and senators back at that time, and not one of them responded to me. I wrote them a simple letter saying, here's my idea, let's make this thing happen. Nobody responded. So that started a series of about 12 to 14 trips to Washington, D.C., where I went there in person. My mission was to find out why these women weren't responding to my letter. And what happened was, when I showed up in person, it was a totally different thing. Because, you know, they get hundreds of letters, suggestions, ideas, and some might be a little bit off the wall, but when they saw that I was for real, I was a surgeon, I didn't want any money for myself, I didn't want congressional lines to be redrawn so that somebody else could win an election, I just wanted a stamp. It put a genuine type of focus on the idea, and so I had formed several very close friendships with representatives and senators who, after about a year and a half, and as I mentioned, a dozen or so trips, introduced legislation that actually forced the Postal Service, or gave them the authority, to in fact produce a fundraising stamp. And that's sort of the genesis of the stamp.
And how did you go about finding someone to design it?
Actually, that was done by the U.S. Postal Service. They hire people to design it. And the stamp was designed by Whitney Sherman, who is a brilliant artist, and the artistry is actually beautiful. It's a picture of Diana Artemis, who's the Roman mythological protector of women. And what she's doing is she's reaching for her bow and her quiver to fend off an enemy of women, which in this case is breast cancer. And the position that she assumes as she's pulling the quiver out of her, or the bow out of her quiver, that position is the position for breast self-exam and for clinical examination, and sometimes for mammographic filming as well. So there's a subtle reminder in there for the women to get their examinations done. So in that sense, it's a very powerful piece of art. And the rainbow of colors represents the fact that it's a disease that affects women of all colors. And also, the rainbow is traditionally seen as a symbol of hope. In this case, it's hope for the cure.
That was originally issued in the late 90s. What year was that?
It was 1998 that the first stamp came
out. And the reissue was this past December, correct?
Well, it's been reissued. Actually, the official reissue was this past September, but it's been reissued every 4 years. Because I have to go back to Congress every 4 years and get another law passed that extends the stamp another 4 years. It's expiring this year again, December 31st, but I already have legislation introduced in the House and in the Senate. The bills are already in place, and they're moving forward to extend the stamp.
And this is in several countries now. It's not just the United States.
Right. It's in, I'm proud to say, the second country that issued it was actually my native country. Hungary. And then we have it in about 25 other countries, and there's still others pending introduction to the stamp. And any country that's not hostile to the United States is allowed to use the image for free. And then they translate the verbiage on the stamp, help fund, fight, find a cure. And they put their own monetary value on it. And then every country that issues a stamp keeps all the money in that country.
Now, Breck and Joe, how did you meet the doctor? How did your paths cross?
Well, I met Dr. Bodai 15 years ago. It was 2000.
Seems like only yesterday.
It does. Yeah. It's flown fast. A lot of good times, a lot of good stuff's happened since. But I met him. I went to Kaiser at the time. I was involved in an event called Last for Life. It was a comedy show to benefit breast cancer. And we actually were working with another organization at the time. And I walked in to Kaiser to see if they'd sponsor the event. And as I was sitting at the table, they had their marketing crew and they had another fella that was a marketing arm for Cure Breast Cancer Incorporated, which is Ernie's nonprofit. And then this guy pulled in and sat down next to me, and I thought it was the janitor. I really did. I tell this story and people laugh because he was wearing something very similar to what he's wearing right now. And when they asked me, are you going to have Dr. Bodai involved in this event? Because if it's not, if Dr. Bodai is not involved in this event, it's not a true breast cancer event. I had heard his name three times that week. And finally I said, who is this Dr. Bodai guy? And the janitor reached over and extended his hand and said, hi, I'm Ernie Bodai. And then he went on to tell his story, which I won't go into because he's told it pretty much here. I've heard a lot of what he talked about today. He talked about that day. And all I kept thinking to myself was, why didn't I find this man sooner before I decided to work with this other organization? Because you felt his genuineness and you understood that you're listening to a man, as you are today, who is very focused on one thing, and that's making majority women's lives, quality of life, better. The following year, I worked with him on Last for Life, and we worked with Cure Breast Cancer Incorporated, his local nonprofit, which is a tremendous organization and raised through the years a lot of money for patient support, for local research and education. And about 95% of every nickel that went into the organization went towards those purposes, which is very, very extraordinary this day and age. You know, a lot of the nonprofits, and there's some great nonprofits out there that are turning more of an 80-20 ratio and 20% being administrative and that sort of thing. They didn't have those costs because Kaiser was funding the costs, the administrative costs for most part. And there were just some small expenses maybe that money went towards. So that's how I met him, and through the years, I've done various projects with him, and I can tell you, I met what I consider two saints on earth, and one of them is Sister Libby here, who runs the local Loaves and Fishes chapter, and the other saint that I met is Saint Bodai, sitting to my right.
Nice saint bookends.
Thank you.
And how about you, Brett?
Well, I met Dr. Bodai through my good friend, Big Joe Whalen, and like Joe said, he's been involved for a number of, what did you say, 15?
15.
Yeah, that's a long haul. Joe and I are fast friends, and we actually do some work together. And I got the opportunity to meet Dr. Bodai through Joe. And my mom is a breast cancer survivor. She's on her second go-round at 75 years old, and she's kicking ass.
Yeah, mom.
I'm proud to say, yeah. So, you know, the more we started conversations and all that kind of thing, I wanted to get involved, and we just kind of kept roundtabling and met the team. Ernie's team is fantastic. I can't name everybody, but the team behind his effort, starting with me, for me, with Joe, is outstanding. I have so much respect for both of these guys on a lot of different levels. One is I like being around smart people.
Sometimes it rubs off.
And, you know, I'm not so sure it's working with me, but I'm trying, right? So, brilliant. Both of these guys are brilliant. And the effort's a big thing for me. Ernie's story is unbelievable. And if you can get out and hear Dr. Bodai talk, do his full speech, what do we call it? Speech?
Talk. And he customizes the talk.
It's a talk, you know.
He customizes the talk for the occasion.
Yeah, exactly. It's educational. This is affecting everybody. You know, at some point it's going to touch you. This cancer thing's going to touch you. I hate it. It pisses me off. And having people like this on the front lines doing creative things like this stamp are a huge deal. So that's how I got involved, and I'm trying to just have a little impact
i.e. the Blue Gaucho Project.
Yeah, the Blue Gaucho Project just kind of evolved. The Blues for the Stamp is what Joe and I kind of brainstormed. And, you know, I've been in Sacramento since the late 80s and around the music scene a little bit. We coming off the Last for Life idea, so we decided to maybe throw together a small event revolving around music and art and food. The key to it, and I remember asking this question, I was like, you know, so what's the ultimate goal here? Well, the ultimate goal is to sell stamps. And we're very quickly approaching selling 1 billion stamps. Is that
yes.
right? And
it's not too shabby.
It's generated in the neighborhood of...
probably $90 million plus... That's just in the United States. I don't know the international numbers. I don't have access to those. So internationally, we're well over a billion stamps.
Yeah.
But in the United States, we're at about 992 million. So we only have about 8 million to go before that 1 billionth mark. Yeah.
Which is incredible when you think about the stamp came out in 1998 when the height of the internet began. And the Elvis stamp was the number one selling stamp in the history of the Postal Service. It came out in 1980. It was on the market for 10 years. It was the price of a regular commemorative stamp, a regular postage stamp. The breast cancer stamp comes out in 1998 during the email era. And also, there's an extra charge for it. That's the research money. And exceeds Elvis in 6 years during the height of the email. And I think that speaks to the power of when people understanding cancer and be going through some process along the way and the importance of helping find a cure for cancer. We're also proud of the idea this man came up with, and who wouldn't want to get behind that? And one thing I always say is it's one of the best kept secrets in the Sacramento area is that stamp started here. You know, it really did. The idea started here. One of the things that really I dug about my first meeting with Breck was when we were going through some marketing ideas, and I brought up the stamp. And he said, oh, yeah, I know the stamp. And I was thinking, okay, he's going to tell me the pink ribbon again. Yeah, nothing against the pink ribbon. Don't get me wrong there. He said, no, dude. And he pulled out. He had a stamp in his wallet. It was breast cancer. He was buying breast cancer research stamps because of his mother's situation a long time before. So what a great idea that he came up with while he was doing his Christmas cards one year.
One thing that's interesting to me when I start talking to people about the stamp is a lot of people don't know exactly where the money goes. I'll let Dr. Bodie talk about that. But it's really interesting to me because I think it's important for people that are spending extra money and putting an effort into it that perhaps it's about more than just maybe the breast cancer element of it.
And the awareness you
need. Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up. I'll tell you that 70% of the money goes to the NIH and the National Cancer Institute, and 30% goes to the Department of Defense. A lot of people are alarmed when they hear Department of Defense, but they don't realize that the DOD has an incredible research arm, which deals with breast cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, and a number of other malignancies. You know, the DOD is actually the largest research organization in the world because they have to deal with diseases all around the world. And a very important point is that some of the advances that have been made in the breast cancer world actually apply to other cancers as well. So there's advances that are helping people with lung cancer, with colon cancer. With
overlap.
There's overlap. Research always cross-fertilizes. So you find genes in one cancer that also affect another cancer. You find drugs that work for one cancer also work for another cancer. So we really are fighting cancer on all fronts, not just breast cancer. It's under the auspices of breast cancer, but we're actually extending out to all the other malignancies as well.
Now, I understand the Blue Gaucho Project has written a song in tribute to the doctor and his work.
I've been inspired to write multiple songs. I think the song you're referring to is called Bodie Express. Bodie Express is most definitely a live tune with a full band. And yeah, if you want to hear it live, come on out September 17th to Harlow's Nightclub. We're going to have Blues for the Stamp. Dr. Bodie will be there. We have Jesse Bridges as a headliner with a special guest, Tim Marcus, who's a great monster pedal steel player. Some great musicians.
So, Doctor, I noticed on the curebreastcancer.org site, you've asked for survivors to share their stories. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, it's sort of an open blog, you know, and I've found over the years that ladies who are willing to share their stories, some prefer to be private, you know, I totally respect that, but some of the ladies who share their stories can provide encouragement for newly diagnosed patients and help them understand that this is perhaps a significant bump in the road, but they'll get through it. And so I think the survivor stories that are on there, and anybody's welcome to post one, serves as a tool for ladies to deal with the diagnosis. Because most ladies, when they're diagnosed with breast cancer, they're devastated. And they're looking for hope, and they're wanting to hear that women survive this and make it through it. And that's what these ladies have been sharing on the website. And so I think it serves as a very strong, inspirational, motivational tool for the ladies who are newly diagnosed as they proceed through their treatment and head into survivorship.
And to quote a classic song, the impossible will have to take a little while.
Yes, excellent.
Another way you can help is with handwritten supportive letters to women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer. Visit girlslovemail.com for details. Which stamps to mail them with? So, to recap, Dr. Badai has spent his own money, hundreds of hours personally pushing and prodding breast cancer research funding, including appearing before Congress every 4 years to renew legislation to help save lives of people we love. The least we can do is buy the stamps. Do something different. Buy a pack of stamps and use them for your Christmas cards this year.